No, interesting. All right, Lauren, will we see a significant energy transition or climate policy moves this year?
No.
That's so sad.
It's sad, but it's true. Hello, and welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Julia, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts, Nicole, Leo, and Lauren. In 2022, we recorded 62 fantastic episodes discussing topics from Ukraine to cybersecurity to US-China relations.
In this episode, we'll be having a roundtable discussion on our biggest foreign affairs moments of the year. As a disclaimer for the episode, the format of the roundtable makes it difficult for POFA hosts to fully explain their opinions and respond to every matter. If you have thoughts or opinions on the format of the episode or the series as a whole, please feel free to send POFA an email at hopkinspofa@gmail.com.
We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
All right, so 2022 was a great year, an interesting year for foreign affairs. A lot's happened, but let's start with you, Leo. What was the moment of the year for you?
I guess since I'm going first, I get to pick the easy one, the elephant in the room, which is, right, in my opinion, the war in Ukraine, right? So a little background to that war. In late 2021, Russia started building up troops on its border with Ukraine. And then on February 24th of 2022, Russia launched the invasion, which it termed a special military operation targeting the capital of Ukraine, Kyiv, and then also after that initial push was rebuffed by Ukraine, Russia's assault focused more on the eastern regions of Ukraine, the Donbass region specifically. And what I thought was remarkable about this war, or what was interesting about it, was the Western response. So you have these countries in NATO and the EU, and then some other ones mainly focused around US, Canada, and Europe, and they respond pretty quickly with very harsh sanctions. Even Switzerland got involved in the sanctions, which is notable in and of itself. And then you begin, starting around the summer of 2022, you start to see military equipment being given or loaned to Ukraine en masse. So you start seeing drones, artillery, ammunition, and now we're starting to see tanks being given to Ukraine. And so this is quite an interesting turn of affairs, because it sort of catapulted Ukraine into being a very, very militarily powerful country, sort of out of nowhere, because it's being given all this equipment. And it also has implications for the unity of NATO and the sort of alliance between Europe and the United States. And to me, it feels like every so often there's a change in the strategic balance in some way, and that means that NATO has to change the way that it operates. And so, founded after the Second World War, NATO, and then in the 60s, you have a sort of turn towards the two-pillar policy of deterrence and detente. And then after the Cold War, you have a shift toward expansion eastward, the inclusion of countries like Poland and the Baltics and Hungary. And now it seems like with this invasion, we've seen a sort of reaffirmation of that strategic change after the end of the Cold War to expand eastward and to support those countries in the East. That's how it seems to me, at least. And so that's going to be important going forward, I think, as to what is NATO's strategy going forward. Is the alliance still relevant? And the 2022's answer to that seems to be, yes, it is still relevant.
Yeah, that's a great point, Leo. And I think you make a lot of great points, what you just said. And actually, like when you were talking about like going back to the Cold War and making these connections between what's happening now with like how the Cold War ended, how World War II ended, I think based on what I've been reading, that's a lot on point about describing like how this started out. I think I think with the way that Putin has viewed things and how he's made it clear that, you know, he feels like Ukraine is part of Russia. He's felt like he's made it clear that he wants to, he views that Russia is not like in a state now is not the Russia that he wants to have, right? He's made it clear that he wants to turn Russia back into the territories that it's had during Imperial Russia time. So I think that was a big factor in the invasion for me. And I also agree that the question now from 2022 and into next year and probably a lot longer is, well, what's going to be the West's response? How relevant is NATO going to be? And I think this is going to be a drawn out war. Just based on the fact that it's really hard to come up with a solution or a compromise between the two. I also think that we need to be careful as we go forward about infighting between amongst ourselves, especially with how united of a front we present with NATO and as well as with our other allies. I've already seen in the media, and I think it's fair, people bring up relevant criticisms and points about, oh, should we continue delivering supplies to Ukraine? Should we, like, how much should we continue sending money there or, like, at the expense of Americans? And I think that's fair, but I do think that the resolution, quote unquote, of the war will hinge on the fact that we continue to present a united front. With that said, I think I was looking and thinking about what might happen in the upcoming year. And I think that if there is a ceasefire, which I think is possible because both Ukraine and Russia have a lack of people, there's been reports that I think the Russian side have been recruiting from prisons or something. So I know with especially Ukraine as well, there's not an infinite amount of manpower. There's not an infinite amount of resources. So I think a ceasefire is possible. But I do think that when that time comes, it's really important to not just let a ceasefire happen on Russia's terms where they're able to regroup and recalibrate and continue the fight elsewhere. So I think that will be an interesting point to watch in 2023 or onwards.
Yeah, I guess I would like ask you guys, like, well, Julia said that you said that you think that compromise is probably unlikely, but maybe a ceasefire. Does anyone think that maybe the war ending due to a military victory on either side is possible?
I mean, anything's possible. Anything could happen. Nicole, I just, to me, it's sort of like, I don't really know. I mean, you know, it seems Ukraine has been very successful initially in the war in rebuffing Russia's attacks, but are things grinding to a halt? Is it going to stay a halt? And I mean, I think it's these sorts of questions that we don't really have the answer to yet and can't really know that prevent us from understanding whether or not a ceasefire would be in favor of Russia or Ukraine.
Yeah, and to jump on that, I think it's unlikely with the situation like that we see now that there's going to be a military victory on Russia's side. And I'm saying that because I think it's unlikely for NATO, the US, and our other allies to allow that to happen because it does seem like if Russia is allowed to like make these moves that explicitly violate, right, the current international order, the current rules, per se, of the international system, and then they're allowed to win and then get away with it, I think that sends a very bad message, right, to its allies or potential sympathizers or countries that might also be thinking about doing something like that but hasn't. And so I think if a military victory were to happen, it would have to be on Ukraine's side. And for me, looking at the situation and how hard it's been for like all of the West to come together and, you know, give help of aid and supplies, I think that would be difficult. So for me, it sounds like or it feels like the war is going to be a long one.
I guess the question that everyone has when, you know, there's any sort of military conflict do we think that this is going to escalate to, you know, talks about going nuclear? I know Putin has sort of hinted at it. That's a really scary thought to have. I personally don't think that'll happen, but I don't know. It's been thrown around and I want to hear what you guys think.
Leo, do you have any thoughts first?
my take on when a country would use nuclear weapons is that only a country that is losing a war will use one. Or I think a country that is losing a war will be more eager to use nuclear weapons to get itself out of whatever rut that it's stuck in. And so, I mean, as Julia said, and I agree with her estimation that an outright military victory for Russia is probably not likely. I mean, there's certainly a risk of nuclear war there. I think we all just have to sit and hope that they wouldn't actually do that. And we have to hope that even if Putin were to press the button, that other members of the government, other officials would get in the way and jam up the works and not really allow that to happen. Because we just don't know what happens next. Because it's not like the West can just let Russia nuke a country.
Yeah.
And so the response is just, who knows? And it just throws a lot of instability into the situation. So we really just have to hope that nobody's crazy enough to do that.
I mean, I think I agree. I agree that that's my hope, certainly. But I don't know how much weight I put on hopes and dreams. I have to say there is worry there for me, because Putin has said in the past that he's not afraid to use nuclear weapons and he's threatened to do so in the context of this war. And sure, you can say that that's just a lot of threats and propaganda. Maybe that won't actually ever happen. But I mean, in the past, we've seen Putin not shy away from using other types of like weapons, like chemical weapons, that have had a huge impact on not just his target, but like public society as a whole. I mean, look at what he did with, I think, Alexander Litvinenko, like that they've poisoned him with radioactive polonium, and then it spread around London. And he's used weapons with Navalny, with a bunch of other cases. And so, sure, it's not the same as nuclear weapons, but it is worrisome. And also the fact that there have been reports coming out that he's surrounded himself in an echo chamber of officials or people who agree with him and don't really push back. I think that's a very frightening direction in how this is going. But again, I think it's unlikely that nuclear weapons will come out until, like Leo said, things get dire and like one side, maybe Ukraine, is like on the brink of victory or something.
So if we assume Julia's right, that this is going to be a drawn out war, I guess my question is, how do we prevent it from being drawn out too long, you know, to the point where it does escalate to some sort of nuclear war, or it's just like not working out in favor of, I guess, Ukraine. What do we have to do then? How does the West have to respond now? And what do you guys think?
What has to happen?
It's a big question, but I don't know.
I think it's likely to be a drawn out war, but I don't think the use of nuclear weapons will come from the fact that it's long, because, you know, both sides don't really have, like, the fact that it will be drawn out is because that both sides don't have unlimited resources and people to fight. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think we'll see that happening. I do think there is a good likelihood that there will be a pause sometime during that time frame. And I just think mm-hmm. that the West needs to be united, and they need to present Putin with a way out that doesn't excuse like what happened, but also doesn't completely destroy de facto what his position is. Now, I don't know. I have no idea what that would look like. But I don't know. Maybe Leo or Lauren wants to jump in and provide some of that information.
I guess we won't know. Like, time will tell us, but I don't know. I think it's like a fun thought experiment.
Yeah,
we can pivot, I think, to Latin America, which for me, I think a lot happened in the region. And I think Lauren will agree with me. But
yeah,
just what for you, Lauren, what was a big moment in the region that was significant, you know, for the more general international affairs.
Mm-hmm. So I definitely think it is the sort of reappearance of leftist governments in Latin America. So as everyone knows, we've seen in Brazil, Lula, who was the president from 2002 to 2010, was elected over former president Bolsonaro. And Lula has been kind of known for the economic bounce back during his presidency in the early 2000s. And he's pledged to help fight food insecurity, to unite Brazil, and also help the current economy bounce back. And we've also seen in Colombia, Gustavo Petro being elected over Hernandez. So he's actually the first leftist president in Colombia. And this especially means a lot because the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which is a sort of leftist insurgency, has been really making it difficult for there to be a legitimate leftist movement in the country. So Petro has been calling for social program expansion, economic reform, oil exploration, and higher taxes on the rich. And we've also seen protests in Peru, protests against the current political instability, people calling for the implementation of a new constitution and calling for new elections. So many people are kind of calling this a pink tide, which refers to a sort of leftist turn in governments in Latin America. And in my opinion, we talked a little bit about this in our podcast on Peru with Chris Sabatini. But my opinion on kind of deeming it this pink tide is that this is sort of not really a pink tide. There's a lot more nuance there when we talk about the movements in Latin America. I mean, if you think about Brazil, we need to understand that the electoral results were had very slim margins. So Lula won 50.9% of votes compared to 49.1% for Bolsonaro. And we recently saw the kind of storming of the Capitol or the Congress, which is kind of mirrors January 6th in the United States, in Brazil. So they're still facing some sort of pushback by the right when it comes to this sort of pink tide. And we also have to understand that Lula sort of faces a different set of circumstances now in Brazil. There's new context with China and the economy. And I guess I'm looking forward to seeing how he handles these issues and how he kind of combats a lot of the right majority in the government. In Colombia, I mean, we're still seeing instability in the government. We're still seeing a polarized society and violence within local communities. So it's really hard for me personally, I think, to call this a pink tide when we haven't really seen the full effects on the ground yet. And we haven't really seen how any of this has really, any of the effects that the government has implemented yet. So I'm excited to see how this plays out in 2023. Nicole, do you have any input?
No, definitely. Yeah, I definitely agree with a lot of your points because I think exactly what you said. It's kind of easy to look at a lot of these election results, a lot of the events happening in Latin America and sort of easily calling this a pink tide. But you're right that there's more nuance to this because I think in most politics, honestly, but definitely in Latin America, there's always this sort of pendulum that happens in politics. And like you said, a lot of these countries that you mentioned, Peru, Colombia, it's still very very much polarized, and there's no, like you said, no real ideological shift on the ground that's happening. But I will say that I'm a little bit optimistic about it because at least in Brazil's case with Lula, like he definitely will have a better environmental approach. You know, if you think about the Amazon and deforestation, definitely better compared to Bolsonaro. Even if, you know, there's still a lot of unrest happening politically. And yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait to see if he really does fulfill his promises when it comes to the environment, you know, protecting the interests and rights of indigenous groups, and, you know, implementing the social programs that he's promising. But yeah, I think in that case, it's really good. And I'm optimistic on that end. And but yeah, Julie, I think you had something to say.
Yeah, sure. Admittedly, I don't know that much about the region. But I will say that I think you guys do have a good point of being cautious when calling it a true pink tide. On the first hand, because I do remember that a lot of people who lost the election, I think, like leading up to this quote unquote pink tide, were incumbents, first of all, and incumbents who were elected during COVID and then during the horrible health crisis and economic issues that happened right after. And so I do think that likely the fact that a lot of left of center leaders winning their elections recently probably has a lot to do with that as well. The fact that people probably didn't want to elect the incumbents who are there and were a sign of the, you know, maybe poorer decisions or at least the outcomes that happened during that time. I'll also note that I also remember that I think in 2000, right, Latin America also had a quote unquote pink tide. Mm-hmm. I think that one was fueled by, I guess that one I think is a good contrast because at that point there did seem to be more like shared like ideologies or ideas between people who were elected. I think I remember Venezuela and there was a lot of oil. Yeah. And then in addition to that, China was rising. And so you had a lot of markets there. And so I think this does pose a great contrast to that, where now it doesn't seem like those governments have as much of a political or ideological similarities with each other. And that just makes me think that this pink tide is potentially more precarious than before. And yeah, I don't know what really will come out of it. I know, Lauren, you've had some thoughts, and as well as Nicole. Mm-hmm. You want to hear maybe Leo, if you have any thoughts as well.
I mean, I just very quickly, I think you're totally right that even like the governments, I think it was Brian Winter on the podcast with Lauren on the elections in Brazil. I remember him saying something about how even the leftist governments are not on the same page. Like they all have very different standings when it comes to China, when it comes to the US, when it comes to Venezuela. They're even the left leaning governments are not sort of aligned, because I don't know. I think also it's Latin American as a region is a lot of times sort of people make generalizations and it's treated as a monolith, which is it's very like we have to be cautious there too. And with that sort of caveat, I wanted to also comment on Julia, you saying something about how COVID sort of affected some of these elections. I think Latin America, I don't want to generalize again, but I think in general, that region has sort of still been recovering, like kind of behind schedule compared to other regions, which is also something that I'm excited to see if like some of these new presidents and elected officials kind of are able to turn that around and maybe we can see some positive economic growth through the region. But Lauren, I want to pass it on to you because I see your hand raised.
Yeah, definitely. I actually had a question for you guys, kind of based on your comments. I know Winter and Sabatini both kind of noted that Latin America, again, not to generalize, but it has been pretty volatile in the sense of like politics and the economy. And I was just wondering, I mean, we've seen a little bit of the leftist movement come through. Do you think there's going to be like a lot of right wing pushback? And do you think in future coming elections that other countries will either have like right wing governments or will they transition to left wing governments?
I think it's tough to say because to me, it feels like Lula specifically ran his campaign around nostalgia for his previous term. So it was like, look at how good our economic situation was then. And if you want that again, you'll have to bring me back. You'll have to bring back Grandpa. And I think that perhaps whether the pendulum swings back in Brazil specifically maybe depends on whether the economic situation does get a does include a steady recovery from COVID.
I had another question I wanted to ask you guys. So I've been reading a little bit about what like other countries' reactions to the pink tide has been, and especially the US's. And I know I've read that a lot of experts have signaled some kind of surprise on like what on the fact that the US has actually been a little bit more accommodating, congratulating Lula on winning, and you know, I think Blinken visiting Cuba and some other countries. So how do I phrase this? So I wonder, like, what do you guys think? Is this promising in terms of like how a signal in how the US's relationship with a lot of Latin American countries might improve from now? Or what do you make of this potential change in posture? Or is it a change at all from the norm or from the past?
Yeah, I definitely think, I've also seen some headlines, you know, even with like Venezuela, you know, relations with the US kind of getting better. And I definitely think there's a shift happening. And I think it kind of has to do more broadly with like US-China tensions in terms of, you know, China investing a lot in a lot of the infrastructure projects happening in Latin America, development projects. And I think the US is kind of, you know, trying to catch up with them on that end and sort of strategically getting closer with its, neighbors, its American neighbors as a way to sort of offset Chinese influence. So, yeah, I definitely see that happening more next year or throughout this coming year. So, yeah. I think, yeah, we can move on. And if anybody wants, I think, Julia, do you want to talk about US-China tensions?
Yeah, sure. So
on that note,
exactly. Leo stole my moment of the year, which was the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I had to come up with another one. And not too creatively, I will say, mine is the, I guess, rising US-China tensions that we've seen this past year. But not just that. I guess I wanted to highlight like that we finally got a U.S. national security strategy. Now, I know every administration has in the past published a national security strategy, at least one. And in the past, it has come at least like a couple months, 9 months, 10 months after the administration has come to power or has taken over. And this one took a remarkably longer time. I think it's been like 2 years. 2 years since the election. So that was the first thing of note. I think I remember reading that maybe part of the reason why that happened was because they had it ready, I think, in the spring. But then the invasion of Ukraine happened and they realized that they had put remarkably less weight on Russia and Ukraine than they had wanted to. And so publishing that national security strategy with very little weight on Ukraine at such a time would not have been opportune. And I think that does symbolize a little bit of the unpreparedness that we've seen in this administration, especially with respect to the response to what's happened in Ukraine. I will say, however, this past year has been has shown that the U.S. administration, the Biden administration, has remained maintained a stronger stance on China than we've seen in past Democratic administrations. I know a lot of people might have been worried after Trump left that maybe we would be going back to a like softer take on China. And it seems like from this past year, you know, there's been increased like Chinese companies that were added that were like listed for possible delisting from U.S. stock exchanges. Pelosi has maintained her position to visit Taiwan despite threats. And so I think this has shown that the administration is still taking the Chinese issue seriously. And specifically, we've seen that the U.S. Department of Commerce implementing the new export controls on advanced computing and semiconductors. I think that was a big deal in U.S.-China relations. And just to give listeners who might not have been keeping keeping updated with that. Semiconductors are processing chips that are used in virtually in a lot of technologies, but especially for the development of AI, supercomputers, advanced weaponry. And so the Chinese economy, I think, has in the past tried to become independent of foreign economies by developing their own semiconductors, but I don't think they've been successful. So they've still been relying on imports from foreign countries like the US to use those. And so to prevent China from catching up from a technological standpoint, as some of our podcasts in the past have discussed, we've decided to ban not only the selling of semiconductors to China, but also the selling of a lot of equipment and parts that are needed to develop them. And then also we prevented American companies and citizens from working with Chinese entities on designing and making semiconductors. So I think without a doubt, this is a stronger stance than we've seen in the past. And U.S. national security strategy as well, even though it does go over a lot of things, and I want to hear what people think, what you guys think about that, what your takes are. I will say that it shows that despite what happened in Ukraine, and while it does take a serious stance on that, it is clear that the administration is viewing, from a strategic standpoint, China as its main as the main competitor. And so I do think that this is maybe signaling a increase in the way that U.S. or a more competitive lens in the way that the U.S. treats China in the future.
So I guess I'll ask you, Julia, because I'm curious about this myself. Do we think that, could this result in increased military tensions between the U.S. and China? I mean, is that something that you see on the horizon, or is this entirely a separate issue to that?
Yeah, I know a lot of some people view, like, the military side as separate from the economic side. Like, they're thinking maybe we can collaborate with China economically and, both benefit. And then while on the military side or on certain, like, more military-based things like Taiwan, for example, or the South China Sea, we can view them strictly as a competitor. And while I think that we do need to strike a balance between those two, I don't think we can completely cut off China and compete, take that stance, nor do I think we should completely see China as an ally. I do think that it's impossible to completely separate one from another. I know even in the past year, there's been some escalation of tensions on the military end from both China and the U.S. I remember, preceding Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, I remember China were doing a lot of military drills that invaded Taiwan's airspace. So I think seeing escalation militarily from China is not going to be surprising in response to if we continue a stronger stance against China. But I also do think that I do think such a stance is necessary. I think I've done some reading on what's happened with the rise of the Chinese economy, and especially with a lot of messaging from China recently about how they're viewing the U.S. I do think that it's impossible to just let go of that. I guess I'm definitely not reducing the threat of, a Chinese military response. I think those are real threats. And I do think as we proceed, we need to think about, like, what we're doing and how that's provoking, if it is provoking China. But I think my main point was that just because I don't think we should stop what we're doing or, soften up just because China might have some kind of response. I think we need to take measured steps with that respect.
Right. And I think those are all good points. And I don't mean to completely pivot, but I guess it's still related. Julia, how do you think, or Leo or Lauren, how do you think that, again, let's assume Julia's right, that, or Julia's analysis is correct in the sense that we're seeing a more serious, tightening security strategy from the U.S. as it relates to China. How do we see this affecting, I guess, alliances, partnerships for each side? So the U.S. and its allies, like Japan, also India nearby, is kind of has always kind of taken a neutral stance, and then China kind of partnering with Russia. How do we see this? But that's kind of complicated with Ukraine. How do you guys see that playing out?
I guess I'll get started. And then I definitely want to hear what the rest of you guys think. I definitely don't want to be the only one talking on such a big issue. I will say the national security strategy does highlight, you know, the importance of alliances, and not just formal alliances, but also partnerships and flexible arrangements, whatever we can get, right? From like AUKUS to the Quad to NATO, leveraging those in our response to China. And so I would say I definitely agree. And I really hope we can, like, as we continue, I hope we can see more unity between the US and its allies with respect to the response to China. I think definitely we can't do this unilaterally. I think if we try to implement anything at that scale unilaterally, I don't think it will work. Just a small point on when you talked about the China potentially siding with Ukraine. I think that their response to the war, and especially their maybe lack of response, and especially right. on China's side and their support on state media of Russia, I think that's hurt them more than it's helped them on the global scale so far. And I think especially with that and how they've been handling COVID and the fact that they've needed to put so much attention on COVID domestically, I think that's probably why we haven't seen a huge response from them yet with regards to what's happened so far on the US's side this year. So I think it will be interesting to see maybe when, I don't want to say COVID is over, but maybe when things have gone down a little bit and China can put more of its attention back on the US, I would be interested to see if there's more of a response from them.
No, definitely. Especially because now with them withdrawing zero COVID, they're definitely going to have a rough few months ahead of them.
Yeah, and especially with Xi, I think there's been reports that there's been, like, I think more, what's it called? More, like, less unity within his party, especially during his party Congress. Of course, he was still reelected, but I think that has also been something that he's had to deal with on his plate instead.
Yeah. No, definitely. And we've had an episode on that before too, which is, just want to plug that real quick. But
go listen to that.
go listen to that. And I think, and also the blocking trips to China with Dr. James Lewis, as you talked about trips, semiconductors before a little earlier. Yeah, that's also really definitely worth a listen. Leo, Lauren, anything to add?
I mean, to your point, Julia, I think alliances are going to be very important in whatever happens in U.S.-China relations. And I think we're seeing that play out in Europe right now, where there's a debate among European countries of how close do we get to China? Do we want to position ourselves as opponents to China? Or do we want to benefit from trade with China? And so, you know, there's sort of an ongoing question as to whether this hardening of alliances will happen or not.
Definitely. I think with that, we can talk about something we just brought up.
Good transition.
zero COVID. Leo, what do you think? End of COVID, question mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a major theme of 2022 is changes in COVID in many countries. So here in the US, we have a sort of complete relaxing of COVID restrictions, basically, and a return to normalcy, as it's been called. I mean, there have still been cases in 2022, of course, and it's not completely disappeared, but life has sort of gone away from what it was during COVID. And compare that to China, which the theme of 2022 there might have been zero COVID, even though at the end of 2022, China, as we mentioned, did away with that policy. But that was the major theme of, if anyone has a COVID case, you gotta lock it down, lock everyone in the city down, and mean, that's had effects on, you know, China's economy and whether or not companies that are not based in China want to continue to do business there or produce goods there, because there may have been a realization that, oh, the government can kind of choose to shut down whatever it wants and nobody can do anything about that. So there's been the term of this term of friendshoring. You can listen to our episode with Elizabeth Braw about friendshoring, where companies are thinking of moving to countries that are more politically secure. And it seems to me that COVID has played a large role in that shift, because it showed the world how vulnerable supply lines, especially across the oceans and whatnot, can be. And it also showed the importance of government regulations in whatever country that a company chooses to do business in.
Yeah, Leo, I really liked your analysis of that, especially of maybe the contrasting way that China has dealt with the COVID issue. Since I know you've been looking at this a little, I do have a question. I myself haven't read too much into this, but I know China has kept with their like zero COVID policy despite a lot of unrest and even protests within. And I think it's Xi Jinping's decision that was his like policy. And even during the protests, I remember a lot of analysts saying that, oh, it's unlikely for him to back off at that point. But to my surprise, they did end up ending the zero COVID policy. And of course, that's led to a rise in cases and hospitalizations, and things aren't going too well on the health side in China. I do wonder, like, what do you think drove that final like ending of the policy there? And why has it stayed so long?
I mean, it was a huge surprise to me too, to just wake up one day and then you see the headline, oh, this is no longer a thing that was the policy for months at this point and that everyone was talking about, and now it's gone. I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of things that could have happened within, intra-party politics, and that could have caused this sudden change in the decision. But I mean, to me at the time, it seemed like, yes, analysts were saying, oh, it's probably not going to have an effect, but the protests were quite large and more widespread than you often see in China. And so I think that those could have had an effect.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking on protests, I think we can't really talk about big events that happened in 2022 without talking about Iran. So, yeah, Lauren, I think this is one of your other big moments in international affairs.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess for a little background, the protests in Iran erupted after Mahsa Amini died. Many believe she was beaten and killed by police forces for not wearing her hijab properly, while officials say that she had underlying health conditions that led to her death. These protests are special in that they are led by women, but it's actually united many demographics, including men and including across social classes. We've even seen the Iranian World Cup team protest by not singing the anthem. We've seen protests on college campuses, in town squares, and they've been generally calling for the repeal of the hijab law. And they've been calling for generally the repeal of the hijab law, for government reform, and even the step down of Ayatollah Khomeini, who is the supreme leader of Iran. So the government has responded with extremely fierce crackdowns, arrests. There's been reports of protesters being hanged. However, the protests have been already going on for 3 months already. So I guess what I'm looking forward to seeing in 2023 is if the government continues to respond to the protesters in this kind of violent way, or if there are any sort of government policies that are changing. some news reports have reported some visible cracks in political unity as Iran continues to move further from the West, risking the renewal of the Iran nuclear deal. They recently just got expelled from the U.S. Commission on Women's Rights. We talked to a large extent with Vali Nasser on this topic. In my opinion, we've seen so many protests in Iran that I have a hard time being optimistic about sort of the outcome of this. I want to be optimistic because this is a human rights issue. But I don't know what you guys think will happen in 2023.
Honestly, I'm pretty optimistic about it. I don't know. I know that there was, I think it was like, I don't want to be wrong about the date, but I think it was like towards the end of the end of the 2000s, there was also kind of like a student-led movement. And yeah, like there wasn't a lot that came out of that. But I think something about these protests are, I think, a little different. And I think we've already seen a little bit of the fallout in like, I don't know, I've seen in the news so many just wide solidarity for this movement, like in Iran, like it's not just women, but also men sort of, calling out the morality police or I think that's what it's called. Right. Which I don't know. That's just it. To me, it's a little bit, I can be optimistic about it, I think. And like you said, there's some cracks, politically, and I think hopefully I just want to be optimistic, so this is like why I'm responding like this, but yeah, hopefully I think it'll force the Iranian government to make some sort of compromise with the protesters' demands. So
yeah, I guess for me as of right now, I'm maybe more on like Lauren's boat with being a little pessimistic, just because I don't know. I think from an Iran hardliner's perspective, I think the fear there is like, what will happen if you like make any kind of compromise or give in? You'll probably have to make more concessions, right? Because for someone who's like has such a like strong grasp on power, making any kind of concession could mean that what the protesters are doing is working. And so I just don't see, I think, a feasible way out for the government to make any kind of change. And that's why I'm more on the pessimistic side. I think the protests, definitely commend the protesters' courage. I think I read that the youngest protester is like, who's been arrested is like 15 years old. And so that's pretty insane. And I think the protests have shown that they've lasted a long time, but I think a weakness is that there doesn't seem yet to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, there doesn't seem yet to be like a leader, or it doesn't seem to be a like a movement that has like that kind of organization. And you know, there are pros and cons of like having that, but I think that might lead itself to being less long lasting.
I mean, yeah, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about what we asked Vali Nasser on the pod on what the U.S. can actually do to help, I guess, the protesters. I know a few days ago they actually just implemented newer sanctions because the protests have been subsiding a little. So I guess, what do you think that Biden and his administration can do better if they can do anything, really?
Lauren, I think that's it's a really good question, but it's definitely hard to ask. I know it's funny because I definitely asked a similar question to, I definitely asked Julia and Leo earlier in terms of like Ukraine, I think, what the West can do better. But it's definitely a hard question to ask. And personally, I don't know. I kind of think that they can't really do much. It's kind of more of a domestic issue. I mean, yes, they can definitely put pressure on Iran, but to a certain extent, I think they're just going to do whatever they want. And I don't know. I guess my short answer is I don't think there's much that the US can do, much more than they can do.
And what did
I was gonna ask Lauren, what did our guest to that say?
I think he also agreed with you, Nicole, on that it's really kind of a domestic issue. It's hard for Biden to really do anything other than implement more sanctions, which this has been the 9th round of sanctions.
Oh, wow.
So, publicly condemn what Iran is doing. Other than that, I personally don't see any way that Biden can do anything, or like the international community can do anything other than implement sanctions.
I didn't mean to cut you off, go ahead.
But I just have a really quick thing, which is that I agree. I think, you know, the Iranian government has already not addressed any of the like key issues or the key problems that have led up to the protests, and one of their scapegoats is already blaming the West and blaming the US. And so I think doing more will just create credence into that, rather than having any sort of direct effect that could be a net positive.
Yeah, Leo, if you don't have anything else to add, I think it's time for trivia and predictions.
All right, trivia time. All right, I'll be hosting our trivia. We'll do 3 rounds. And it'll be pretty quick. I will just ask a couple of questions. I'll go between all 3 of you in order, and we'll see how it goes. I think we'll continue the tradition of stealing questions from CFR. That's what we did last year, and that's what we're going to do again. And yeah, so thank you, CFR. Please don't sue us. All right.
Shameless stuff.
What can I say? It's a reflection on how good CFR's questions are. All right. So the first question will be on treaties and peace agreements. All right, Leo. The Peace of Westphalia, a landmark in European history and in the foundation of the modern system of national sovereignty, was reached in which year?
That's 1648, Julia.
Nice. All right. Next question.
Nicole. How did you know that?
Yeah, I was just about to say, I'm quite impressed.
I'm very impressed.
Thank you.
Nicole, the United States signed 2 peace treaties with which country in the first 4 decades of U.S. independence?
Okay. Yeah. So I'm thinking that the answer is between the UK and France, but I'm going to go with the UK.
That is correct.
Oh my God, why'd you get that right? Now the pressure's on. I'm not going to get this right.
Wait, I just saw a really hard question. I'm not going to ask
Give me an easy one. Julia, give me an easy one.
Okay,
please.
I'll just tell you the one that was next, but that I'm not going to ask you, which is, what is the name of the document that ended the Mexican-American War of 1846 to 48? But I won't ask you that.
I know that.
I would have said, like, Mexican-American Agreement or something. It's not right.
I definitely know it. I'm just kidding. I don't know it.
Okay, here it is. Here's one. Here's the one that's doable. Which treaty marked the end of World War I?
Oh, I know this.
Stop.
Wait, okay, everyone cut out my pause for a second while I think.
No, we're leaving that in.
World War One.
Come on, Lauren.
Okay, well, it's not the Treaty of Versailles. Is it? No, that's it is Treaty of Versailles. It is Treaty of Versailles.
Nice.
Oh, that's so easy. Oh my God.
I'll give that to you, Lauren.
Helping out.
Okay, the next round is going to be about non-proliferation, arms control, and disarmament. All right. Leo, this is multiple choice. Which of the following materials can be used to make nuclear weapons? Plutonium, uranium, both, or neither?
That would be both.
Yes. Nice.
I love how confident Leo is. That would be both.
All right, here's one for you, Nicole. The U.S. military maintains three ways to deliver nuclear weapons to an enemy. What is this arrangement called? And I'll give you multiple choice. A, nuclear trio. B, land, air, sea concept. C, rule of three. Or D, nuclear triad.
What? I think it's the triad one.
Yeah, you're maybe. Right. It does sound
Why'd you get it right again?
All right, Lauren, you ready? What is the name of the nuclear doctrine in which a country pledges not to use nuclear weapons unless attacked with them first? And I can give you multiple choice for this one.
Oh yeah, give me multiple choice.
All right. Second strike policy, massive retaliation, deterrent only policy, no first use policy.
Oh, terrible. A?
A was second strike policy. That's incorrect. It's
okay, no, wait, cut this out. C, cut this out.
C is deterrent only policy.
Okay, never mind.
How about we do one on international organizations? All right. Leo. This international organization, one of the oldest in existence, focuses on workers' rights and other employment-related issues. Would you like multiple choice?
I would really like multiple choice, yes.
All right. The WTO, the League of Nations, the ILO, or the UNHCR?
I'm going to say it's the ILO.
Yeah, I think that gave it away. All right, good job, Leo.
Thank you. Would not have gotten that without the multiple choice.
All right, here's one. This one's not too bad, so let's see if we can. This international organization, Nicole, based in Washington, D.C., works to ensure the stability of the global economy. I can give you multiple choice. A, the World Bank, or the OAS, or the GATT, or the IMF?
I'll just guess. I think it's the World Bank.
No, it's the International Monetary Fund, the IMF.
Oh, shoot. That's embarrassing. I'm the first one to get it wrong. Oh, just kidding. Lori got it wrong.
All right, last question, Lauren. I think the reason you get them wrong is because you get all the hardest ones at the end.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Not your fault.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see.
Wait, what's my excuse?
That one was pretty hard. I moved back. All right, last one. Also based in Washington, D.C., this organization aims to promote economic growth and reduce poverty in developing countries. A, the World Bank. B, the OAS. C, the OSCE. Or D, the UN.
And you said economics, so I'm going to go A.
Yes, you're right.
Okay.
The World Bank. Nice. All right. And with that, I will shift it over to Nicole, who will be hosting the predictions round.
Okay, yes. I'm so excited. This is going to be rapid fire. So let's start with Julia. By the way, I should have prefaced. This is going to be very quick yes or no questions, no explanation. You have like 5 seconds to answer. So let's start with Julia, because you got this right on last year's roundtable prediction round.
Yeah, let it be known that I predicted the invasion of Ukraine.
She did. She definitely did. So with that, I want to ask you, you kind of already answered this, but I'll give it to you anyway. Will the war in Ukraine end in 2023?
No.
All right. Lauren. Will China invade Taiwan in 2023?
No.
All right. Leo, will North Korea test a nuclear weapon this year?
Yes.
Ooh, interesting. That's what, I don't know who was asked this last year, but they also said yes, but they were wrong. and let's see, Julia, will U.S. ties with its Western or European allies weaken this year?
No.
No, interesting. All right.
Lauren, will we see a significant energy transition or climate policy moves this year?
No.
That's so sad.
It's sad.
That breaks my heart. But your
questions.
Sorry. And then on a related note, Leo, will the energy crisis in Europe continue?
No.
Interesting. Wait, can I ask a follow-up then? Will Europe manage to completely, I guess, decouple from Russia in terms of oil dependency? Energy dependency?
Not entirely.
Okay. No? Okay. Interesting. All right. Lauren, since you did the Iran pod, I want to ask you, will Iran compromise with post-testers? I think you already answered this, but go ahead.
Unfortunately, no.
And then, Leo, I know you did a pod on Haiti. So will the crisis in Haiti see a significant foreign military intervention this year?
Oh, that's tough. I'm gonna say yes. I'm going out on a limb there.
Honestly, I agree with you. And then this one, I feel like it'll be fun for everyone to answer, but I'll ask Julia. Will the U.S. ban TikTok this year? They better not.
I'm gonna be spicy. I'm gonna say yes.
Honestly, I think so too. I feel like it's gonna be one of those shocking sort of headlines that
yeah, I'm gonna
come
say
out
that,
of nowhere.
And then next year, you guys can say like, yeah, she predicted that too.
That was me and Julia this time. Wait, Leo, Lauren, what do you guys think?
This is off record, but if they do that, I'm pirating a version of TikTok on my phone because there's no way they're taking
it from
me.
So I'm predicting that from me. I'm predicting Lauren gets arrested.
I think not, because it's such a daily part of a lot of people's lives right now. So
personal experience.
Okay, me.
Maybe cybersecurity? Question mark.
Maybe we'll see. I think not though. Maybe in like 2024.
Interesting.
I don't think TikTok's gonna get banned. If you do that, you're gonna have January 6th, but with filters and text to speech instead of
and Gen Z
video. So.
All right, we're split. Wait, I have a question for you, Nicole.
Yeah.
To close us out. Do you have more questions, by the way?
No.
Okay,
that was
I have a question. So by the end of 2023, by December 31st, are the three main dictators still going to be Xi Jinping, Kim Jong-un, and
Putin,
are they still going to be alive and in power by the end of 2023?
Ooh. I'm going to say two out of three.
No, yes or no. All three or not.
Oh my God. That's so horrible. I'm going to say yes. Yes, they're going to be alive. I don't want to predict someone's death. That's so morbid. But honestly, I think not all three will be in power, but I won't say which one.
Okay. Well, actually, you should. Then it'll be really good if you predict
it. No. That's too much pressure. I'm kind of just like, I'm kind of rolling the dice on that one. I don't actually have something interesting to say.
I think any of the three, it's going to be Putin.
It's going to be Putin. Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah, but I just didn't want to say it. But yeah, it'll be Putin.
Or Kim Jong-un. I heard that he started showing his daughter more often or something.
Oh.
Like his favorite daughter.
Didn't he lose hella
that's
weight though?
Cute.
He did. So that's a good sign for him. Maybe not for the rest of the world.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's a good one to end on.
All right. Thank you everyone for tuning in with us as we discuss some of our favorite or most interesting, maybe not favorite, moments of 2022. And we look forward to seeing you guys again at the end of 2023 and see how our predictions panned out. See you guys next time.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.